Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. Last episode, we previewed three immigration-related cases on the court's docket this term, including Jennings v. Rodriguez, a case about whether non-citizens are entitled to a bond hearing before being detained for extended periods of time, sometimes as long as several years. In this episode, I talk with Ahilan Arulananthem of the ACLU of Southern California. Arulananthem represents the respondent Alejandro Rodriguez and a class of similarly situated non-citizen detainees, and he will be arguing Jennings v. Rodriguez before the Supreme Court on October 3rd. Now on to the interview.
I'm speaking today with Ahilan Arulananthem, the Director of Advocacy and Legal Director for the ACLU of Southern California. Ahilan is counsel for the respondents in Jennings v. Rodriguez, a class action lawsuit currently before the Supreme Court concerning immigration detention. We're going to talk about Jennings v. Rodriguez, but first, can you tell us a little bit about the work you do for the ACLU? Give us a sense of the types of cases you're involved in.
Sure. Most of my work at the ACLU has been in the areas of immigrants' rights and national security litigation, and the immigrants' rights cases, for the most part, have been about trying to secure basic procedural protections for immigrants in the deportation process. So Jennings, which is I've worked on longer, I think, than any other continuously running case, obviously is about the right to bond hearings for people detained for prolonged periods of time. I've also done a lot of work on the right to appointed counsel for certain vulnerable immigrants facing deportation and other kinds of similar work.
Let's talk a little bit about Jennings. This case is a class action, but just to give listeners a sense of the type of person involved, can you tell us a little about Alejandro Rodriguez, whose name is in the case name?
Yes. The first time I met him, he said, "Call me Alex." He came here at the age of one, actually before the age of one. He was brought by his parents and grew up entirely in Southern California. Speaks perfect English, entirely integrated. You wouldn't ever know if you met him that he was not a U.S. citizen. He had some run-ins with the law, which are detailed in the briefing. He has a controlled substance offense and also the unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, like a joyriding conviction. But then after his sentences were done, I believe on the second one, if I remember right, instead of being sent back into the community, which is what happens to U.S. citizens, he was sent into immigration detention. And then he spent 3.5 years litigating his removal case because it was complicated. Some immigration cases are simple. Those ones end very quickly. But many of them are complex. And here, the classification of his conviction was very complex. And depending on that classification, his eligibility for relief to remain in the United States was also somewhat complex. This case would have actually taken longer. It took nearly 7 years to finish. But when we filed the class certification motion in his case, the government released him in an attempt to moot the lawsuit. Fortunately, the courts didn't accept that. And then he eventually won his case, won legal status, and now is living here in Southern California. He has a daughter, and lives and works here today.
This is a class action, as I mentioned, and one of the groups of people in the class are people like Rodriguez who were legal residents of the U.S., but they're allegedly removable because of a criminal conviction. But there are also other types of people in this case. You're also representing people who were denied entry at the border in the first place, but they're arguing that they should be eligible. What can you tell us about that class of people?
Yes, there's two groups of people you can broadly say who form the class who are denied entry at the border. By far the most common of those are asylum seekers, people who had no prior authority to a legal basis for residing in the United States, but could have a basis under the asylum laws, because since World War II, the United States has recognized that people fleeing persecution can have the right to asylum, to stay in this country and ultimately have a path to lawful permanent residence and citizenship. The group of people we're representing in that respect are people who come to the border, are given an initial, what's called credible fear screening interview, which is an interview where they determine essentially if the claim is credible and if there's a significant possibility that the person could obtain asylum, and then passes that. And if they pass that, then they're sent into the regular immigration deportation hearings process. But in that hearing, they're arguing for asylum. And those, again, sometimes take a very long period of time, just like Mr. Rodriguez's case. In fact, one of the first clients I had at the ACLU had an asylum case that had taken more than 4.5 years and still hadn't finished. often those take a long time because when the people win, the government appeals. And when they appeal, they can keep the person locked up as they interpret the immigration laws. So the claim for those individuals is also that they're entitled to a bond hearing, just like Mr. Rodriguez was entitled to under our view. And then the other group I should mention is there's a smaller number, but a significant number of returning lawful permanent residents. People just like Mr. Rodriguez who travel abroad and then come back. And those are often very brief trips, like, you know, 2-week trip to see your family in, you know, some other country or whatever. And then upon their return, they're put into removal proceedings because of the prior conviction. And again, the government's position is once you're in that situation, you have no right to a bond hearing. The decision whether or not to release you is entirely in the hands of the deportation officers.
Can you briefly summarize the basic legal issue in the case? You're asking for a bond hearing for people that have been detained for 6 months or more?
That's right.
And as this case first came to the Supreme Court, it was basically a statutory interpretation case. The government said there was no right to a bond hearing. You argued that the statute could and should be interpreted to allow a hearing after 6 months. But kind of lurking in the background behind the statutory interpretation question was the constitutional avoidance doctrine. I wonder if you could explain how that comes into play in this case.
Yes, the courts have long held, more than a century, that where there are two plausible interpretations of a statute, one of which raises serious constitutional problems and the other of which does not, then the courts should favor the one that does not. And the rationales for that are many, but I think the core rationale is the courts can avoid deciding constitutional questions if they construe a statute in a way that doesn't raise it. And doing that is also manifests certain respect for the other branches because it gives Congress then the opportunity to clarify if it actually did mean to push up against the constitutional limits. And we've seen that process play out in various situations in the past, the most prominent one in recent memory being the Guantanamo detainee cases where the court first construed the relevant statute not to prohibit habeas corpus review for Guantanamo detainees. Congress then went back and said, no, we did mean to do that. And then the court considered it a second time. And in that case, of course, struck it down. That has also been the pattern used in a number of immigration cases, again, going back a very long period of time, including recent immigration detention cases, the 2001 decisions of Vitus v. Davis, the 2001 judicial review decision, INS v. St. Cyr, a whole host of others as well, a 2005 detention case called Clark v. Martinez. The court has repeatedly used that doctrine in the immigration context. So yes, that was our primary argument from the inception when we started the case. We won on that ground, on the ground that the statute didn't clearly authorize prolonged detention without hearings in the Ninth Circuit. And that was how we presented it to the court as our primary argument for why the decision should be affirmed.
So this case is scheduled to be argued on October 3rd. It'll be the second day of argument for the new court term coming up. But this is actually the second time this case is going to be argued. You argued this case already last year, and then some interesting things happened after that argument. First, there was some post-argument briefing. Basically, the court came back and asked the parties for new briefs specifically addressing constitutional issues. I wonder if you could talk a little about that.
Sure. So at the argument, many of the questions were probing the basis for our reading of the statute. And I think it's fair to say that at least some of the questions suggested that some of the justices were skeptical of our reading of the statute. And then we turned to discussing the underlying constitutional problems. And some of the justices, it seemed, suggested that the underlying constitutional question itself maybe was not properly before the court, because the Ninth Circuit had not ruled on the constitutional question. And in fact, it was a fascinating, for me, as I watched it, back and forth between Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kagan about this. Justice Kennedy also asked a question about it. So that was sort of what had happened during the argument. And then just a couple weeks after the argument, the court issued an order asking for full-length supplemental briefing on the constitutional questions. And they literally just took the questions presented and slightly reframed them as questions about whether these practices, the prolonged detention without hearings under these statutes, was constitutional. Then the parties did those. We did another full round
simultaneous briefs, an opening brief and a, you know, cross-opening briefs, cross-reply briefs on the constitutional questions. And then on the last day of the term, they set it for re-argument.
When the court does that, when it sets it for re-argument, they don't officially explain why. They just said it was set for re-argument. But basically, it was an 8-member court at the time. This was before Justice Gorsuch had joined when you argued it. And it basically means there was a 4-4 deadlock and they need to break that tie.
So I'm not a Supreme Court expert, but it is my understanding that sometimes cases get re-argued even when there isn't a 4-4 divide. I don't know. I have literally zero inside knowledge about whether what the breakdown was here. I think you know that there were not 5 votes for one single view, because presumably if there were, then they would have issued an opinion explaining that already. But no, we're definitely going in on the assumption that, you know, every justice is potentially in play the same way that we did when we first argued it. So, you know, obviously you can look at their background and how they voted in other cases and have some sense of who you're more likely to have a sympathetic ear with than with others. But we're not going in on the assumption that, oh, it must have been a 4-4 deadlock. And part of that is because, as we started at the outset saying, you know, you've got two different classes of people that, you know, are in play. There's also, I think, a lot of very complex questions about what kind of relief is possible. So there's just a lot of moving parts, and I'm not sort of convinced either that it was 4-4 before or that it will break on any particular spectrum, you know, in the court.
There have been a few other interesting issues that have come up related to this case. One is an issue that came up about a previous Supreme Court decision, DeMoore v. Kim, where the government had provided statistics to the court about the lengths of detentions, and it later came out that those statistics were inaccurate. I wonder if you could talk a little about that.
Yes. DeMoore v. Kim is one of the two most important precedents in our case. So there's two modern Supreme Court cases about prolonged detention that discuss the constitutional issues at some length, and that is one of them. So it's extremely important. And when I say it's about prolonged detention, the length of the detention that issue in DeMoore v. Kim was a central subject of dispute between the parties and the case itself. And as you mentioned, the government put in for the first time in the Supreme Court data. It was ostensibly about the length of detention. That was a relevant question, but the data was actually not about that. It was about the length of proceedings. And even as to the length of proceedings, it excluded a number of cases that should have been included. And, you know, yeah, there was a whole host of problems with that data. That did not come out until much later when, actually shortly before our case went to the Supreme Court, when there was a FOIA request and the Wall Street Journal article about that revealed that there were all these data errors. And the day they filed their merits brief in our case, the Solicitor General filed a letter in the DeMoore v. Kim docket describing some of the errors. The letter actually, in some respects, suggests that the opinion should be amended in light of the fact that some of the claims made about length of detention are wrong. But of course, the justices who wrote that opinion, some of them, including Chief Justice Rehnquist, who authored it, are no longer with us. And those assumptions about the length of detention were central, in our view, to the court's rationale in DeMoore v. Kim. So in our view, it wasn't so simple as just to, you know, cut and paste that phrase. So it's a very complicated and difficult wrinkle in the midst of our case.
Some people have argued that DeMoore v. Kim is to some degree undermined as a precedent because it's explicitly basing itself on inaccurate facts.
Yes, it's a very powerful amicus brief arguing that DeMoore v. Kim should be overruled. And one of the prominent reasons given for that is not just that the facts are inaccurate, it's critical facts central to the rationale of the decision actually turned out to be wrong.
It'll be interesting to see if that plays much of a role in whatever decision eventually comes out. I guess related to the constitutional case, there's another constitutional doctrine that I wondered if you could talk about a little. It's the plenary power doctrine, which is somewhat controversial, but I wonder if you could talk a little about what that means and what role that plays in the case.
Yeah, so plenary power doctrine is commonly just understood to be the doctrine that courts afford some level of deference to the executive branch or to Congress, perhaps in cases involving immigration. I mean, all of this is often very imprecise, but perhaps it's a strand of plenary power doctrine or another doctrine called the entry fiction doctrine, which is that people who are stopped at the border either have no Fifth Amendment rights or perhaps no constitutional rights or perhaps no rights other than those granted by Congress. So perhaps they have the Fifth Amendment right to have the statutory rights enforced, You know, there's many different versions of this somewhat imprecise concept. But broadly speaking, the idea is that if you're stopped at the border, you can't bring a constitutional challenge to the procedures governing your detention. That's how the government has deployed the argument in our case. And they relied heavily on a Supreme Court case from the Cold War called the Shaughnessy v. United States Ex-Rel Mazai. And that case has been often read to stand for some version of the entry fiction doctrine. So I think our case certainly implicates that doctrine insofar as many of the class members in the arriving subclass, all of the arriving subclass actually, are people who have been stopped at the border. And they're arguing that they're entitled to greater procedures with respect to their detention than the government currently affords them. So yes, it does. It implicates that. It's another large, complicated issue sitting in the middle of our case.
Yes, this is a very complicated case. It's been difficult to keep all of the moving parts straight.
You and me both.
Do you have a sense of the scope of this lawsuit? You know, rough idea of how many people fall into the different categories that are in the class action that you're representing, and what are the total number of detainees that we're talking about here?
You know, unfortunately, our data is only about the Central District of California from what we've gotten within the case itself. We have a lot of data about Central District of California because that's the original class. But I think it's probably on any given day nationally several thousand people who have been detained for more than 6 months whose cases are still pending. There were in the Central District of California somewhere between 300 and 400 such people on any given day, you know, out of a total population of somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000. If similar numbers hold elsewhere, it's something like 10% of the population. And that would mean that it would be something like 3,000 to 4,000 on any given day. There's around a little bit more than 40,000 people who will sleep tonight in an immigration detention center. That number also has fluctuated. It increased significantly under President Obama. President Trump has promised to increase it still further, the number of people subject to immigration detention. And since 2014, the number of asylum seekers being detained has dramatically increased. So that percentage of the total, which is the arriving subclass, has increased significantly just in the last now 3 years.
Okay. So for a minute, I think I want to move back from this case and just look at the immigration system a little more broadly, and especially these procedural issues that you focused on. I think it's fair to say that this, the long-term detention issue that in play in this case is only one of many aspects of the immigration system that have drawn a lot of criticism. You mentioned before that you've been involved in the issue of juveniles facing deportation proceedings who are not represented by counsel. Are there other areas that you've been involved in directly relating to immigration proceedings?
Yes. The first case that we did on the counsel side was about people with serious mental disorders who were not provided appointed counsel. We won the counsel part of that case in 2013. And that also involved people subject to very prolonged detention. In fact, my client, lead plaintiff in that case, Mr. Franco Gonzalez, was detained for more than 4 years. And his case was essentially lost in the immigration system. He had no lawyer. He had no active proceedings. He was just sitting there essentially like in indefinite detention. And there's also a number of people who are detained for very long periods of time simply because they can't pay their bond amount. And that, of course, is true in the criminal system as well. But there are certain protections afforded to people in the criminal system on that in that respect, too, that are not of it in the immigration detention system. So, you know, it's not to say that nobody can ever be deported or that, you know, nobody can ever get locked up, but that when you lock them up, you should have a hearing with a judge to figure out if their detention is actually needed. And when you're deporting them, because deportation is a very important loss of liberty for at least many people facing deportation, and that it should be accompanied by the procedural protections that we give to people with other significant losses of liberty, like a lawyer, if they can't afford one.
Just a few weeks ago, there was a Second Circuit decision that was a case about a U.S. citizen who had been declared deportable after basically an incompetent investigation and ended up being detained for more than 3 years while he tried to convince the government he was actually a citizen. And also, just a few weeks ago, the Houston Chronicle published an article based on government statistics suggesting that deportation proceedings are mistakenly initiated against hundreds of U.S. citizens every year. And I wondered if that's something you had encountered in your work.
Yes. We have had many clients who are U.S. citizens who had detainers placed on them, and we've had a handful, I wouldn't say hundreds, but in our office, even just in Los Angeles, we've had a handful over the years of U.S. citizens who were in removal proceedings and detained. And if you talk to the Federal Public Defender's Office, because they're, you know, many people in the situation get deported because they never have a lawyer, don't have the money to hire one. But if you talk to the Federal Public Defender's Office, they will tell you that they've had many such cases, because often they're the first ones who are properly investigating it, because when it comes there in the form of an illegal reentry prosecution, then they're able to investigate it and determine not only did the person not illegally reenter, they're a U.S. citizen. So yes, that is a problem that we are aware of and that we see on a regular routine basis. And I think it underscores another important doctrinal point, which is people often say, oh, well, you know, these rights you're talking about, whether to a bond hearing as in Rodriguez or to legal representation, aren't they different because here we're talking about non-citizens? And I think that's really a category mistake, because non-citizens in the criminal process, of course, do have a right to appointed counsel under Gideon. They have a right to a bond hearing under a whole host of decisions. They're treated the same, for the most part, with respect to their procedural rights available to them as our citizens. And in contrast, if you're a citizen, but the government is trying to deport you, you have no right to an appointed lawyer, as that case in New York sort of tragically showed. And there's a concurrence by Judge Katzmann in that opinion, where he talks about the urgent need for legal representation for people in removal proceedings, and right does not extend under current law even to citizens.
Before we finish, do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share? Or
no, wish me luck.
All right. I'll be looking forward to hearing the oral argument. Where can listeners go if they want to learn more about either this case or other work you're involved in? The ACLU of Southern California, their website is aclusocal.org.
That's right. And there's also a lot of information about this work on the National ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project website. So if you go to www.aclu.org and look at immigrants' rights, there's also a lot of information on that page. And there's information on Jennings V. Rodriguez on both platforms. You can get to it. And if you're interested in learning more about my work, you can find more of that on the ACLU of Southern California website and elsewhere. It's also on the MacArthur Foundation website. And if you Google my name, you can get a sense of the work that I and others have been doing in different areas.
That's great. And again, Jennings v. Rodriguez will be argued on October 3rd. There's no telling when a decision will come down, but expect it before the end of June. I wish you luck, and thank you again for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks for having me.
And that brings us to the end of episode 15. Links to resources related to this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com. That's T-O and the number 5. You can leave comments and questions on the show notes post at countingto5.com or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page, tweet at countingto5, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. You can call and leave questions and comments on the Counting to 5 voicemail line at 774-226-8685. That's 774-2-COUNT-5. We value your feedback, and we're particularly interested in hearing what you think about interviews like this. Send your comments, criticisms, and suggestions, and help shape future episodes of the podcast. If you aren't already subscribing to Counting to 5, please subscribe now to make sure you don't miss future episodes. If Counting to 5 isn't available in your favorite podcast app, directory, or service, please let us know, and we'll do what we can to get it listed. If you're already a subscriber, please do us a favor and spread the word about Counting to 5. Tell a friend or colleague about the podcast or share it on social media. Finally, consider supporting us financially. Go to Counting to 5's Patreon page at patreon.com/countingto5, where you can make a monthly pledge in any amount as low as $1. Patrons have access to exclusive rewards, including special mini explainer episodes, live video chats, bonus audio content, and more. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to 5.